Our study tonight is in Jeremiah chapter 2, verses 9 through 19. God's indictment of Judah for exchanging him for vain crutches. We Christians often view the sin of idolatry as occurring with people in the Old Testament, you know, where they would carve an idol out of wood, or they would make it out of molten metal, and or overlay wood with metal, and then they would fall down and worship the idol. But 1 John 5:21 directs Christians to keep yourselves from idols. Interesting. And Dr. Ryrie explains in his footnotes, an idol is anything that substitutes for God. Sometimes the checking account can substitute for God, or the money that we have in the bank, or in mutual funds or something. Sometimes it could be a personality that we're relying on for stability and security rather than the Lord. Could be anything that we use as a substitute for the Lord. Well, God's indictment of Judah in Jeremiah 2, 9 to 19, regarding Judah's sin of idolatry, actually highlights the way the nation substituted false crutches, that is, false idols, for the true God. And it applies very much to us. I'd like to read the passage, and then we will look at it. Jeremiah chapter 2, verses 9 through 19. Wherefore, I will yet plead with you, saith the Lord, and with your children's children I will plead. Actually, the word plead should be translated, I will bring a charge. For pass over to the isles of Chittim, and see, and send unto Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Has a nation exchanged their gods, which are yet not gods? But my people have exchanged their glory for that which does not profit. Be astonished, O you heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid, O you very desolate, saith the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot even hold water. Is Israel a servant? Is he a home-born slave? Why is he spoiled? The young lions roared upon him and yelled. They made his land waste. His cities are burned without inhabitant. Also the children of Noph, that would be Memphis and Tapnes, have broken the crown of thy head. Hast thou not procured this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God when he led thee by the way? And now, what hast thou to do in the way of Egypt, to drink the waters of the canal Sihor? Or what hast thou to do in the way of Assyria, to drink the waters of the Euphrates River? Okay. There's an interesting series of illustrations that God uses as pictures. And God is very, especially in the Old Testament, he's very graphic in painting illustrations and pictures and using them as teaching tools. God, first of all, indicted Judah for exchanging him for false or vain idols. Verses 9 through 12. After critiquing the forefathers in Jeremiah 2, 5 to 8 for turning to idols, God again brought charges against the forefathers and added charges against their grandchildren, which would be Jeremiah's generation. It's interesting. God doesn't let anybody off the hook. This comes out in the book of Ezekiel chapter 18. God says, if you have a father and he sins, but he has a son and the son doesn't sin, I'll judge the father, but I won't get the son. On the other hand, if the father is righteous, but the son is bad, then I'll judge the son. And then God goes further. He says, now if there's a father, and he's a sinner, and I'm planning on judging him, but he repents, I won't hurt the father. If the son is a sinner, but he repents, I won't hurt the son. And I will not judge the father for the son's sin, and I will not judge the son for the father's sin. And he takes the whole chapter, all of Exodus chapter 18, to clarify that the individual pays for or suffers the judgment of God because of his own sin. And that's very, very interesting, because there are a lot of people who take Exodus chapter 20 and says, God says, I visit the sins of the fathers on the children of the second and third generation. And they think, therefore, the children and the grandchildren suffer because of the father's sins. That's not so. What happens is, in the ancient Near East, you had several generations that lived under a single tent. And if the second and the third generations were party to the grandfather's sins, then the God would judge all the generations. He wasn't going to let anybody off the hook. But the individual that's himself who is righteous or who repents, God will forgive that individual. And God is very, very strong. Even in the Old Testament, God will deal with us individually, and he will discipline us, or he will bless us individually. But here, the grandchildren were just as bad as the father, the great fathers and grandfathers. So the Lord then called Judah's people to cross over to the sea coasts of Kittim, which is Cyprus, in the west, or to Kedar in the east, that was inhabited by North Arabian desert tribes, and observe closely to see if there had been anything there like what had happened in Judah. That astounding event had been Judah's change of deity, what even pagan nations would not do. For the pagans were at least faithful to their false gods, unlike Judah had been to its true God. That's quite an indictment, isn't it? The pagans were worshiping false gods, but at least they didn't change their false god for some other false god. They stuck with their gods. But Israel changed their god for other gods. That's really something. So God called the heavens as witness to be appalled at Judah's exchange of deities, to shudder with great horror at a wickedness that had occurred only in Judah and not even in the pagan lands. It's interesting, when God judges people in the great white throne judgment, God is going to be very, very clear in his judgment. There's no person who's going to be confused and then sent to hell being confused. God's going to clarify exactly what that person has done in his life. In fact, the Bible says he's going to bring up the books, and every single work and every word that that person has spoken has been recorded. He's going to open up the books, and people are going to go back, and he's going to repeat and show them all the things that they've done, what they've said and everything. So when it gets ready to cast them into the lake of fire, there's going to be absolutely no argument. They're going to see, "Woo, I had it coming." So it's interesting how God does this here. Judah, you're worse than the pagans. So do you think that you're going to escape my judgment? The implication is, no way. You're more accountable, and yet you're worse than the pagans. Well, this heinous sin in Judah was comprised of two parts of evil, as illustrated by the Lord in verse 13. On the one hand, Judah's people had forsaken the Lord, forsaking the spring of living water. And remember, the word living water is a figurative for running water. Remember when Jesus talked to the woman at the well? He said, "If you had asked me, I would have given you living water." The word living water is a figure of speech for running water, and that's how she took it at first. Of course, he was meaning it spiritual, but she didn't know it at times. So she says, "Well, you know," and the well in Jacob's well is very brackish and stale, mosquitoes and so forth breeding. It's very, very old. And so she said, "Well, show me where I can get this fountain of running water so I don't have to come and draw at this well." And Jesus, of course, said, "Well, go call your husband," because if you're going to give something to a woman who's a stranger, you have to do it in the presence of her husband. That's the culture. And she says, "I don't have a husband." He went on from there, and eventually he communicated that he was leading her to himself. But living water actually was a figure of speech for running water. So God, in his place, had made their own replacement crutches. They had made, in place of God, who provided them running water, crutches, like digging their own cisterns. And when they would dig a cistern, they would dig a cistern into a rock underground, and then they would plaster the cistern so that it would collect rainwater, and they would divert rainwater so it would come into these cisterns, and these cisterns would fill up. Especially they would do this in cities and in city walls, and the reason for that is they wanted water on hand, so in case the city ever came under siege, they wouldn't have to give up and surrender ahead of time because they had water. But the water that would collect in cisterns, eventually it would be brackish and darkish, and it'd taste stale and everything. It's very, very different from running water. It's not nearly as good. But anyway, these people had dug out their own cisterns into rock caverns and plastered them to hold stale, brackish rainwater that would collect in them. But the cisterns even turned out to be broken, unable to hold even collected stale rainwater. If you had a cistern that was built under the ground and it was into a rock that was broken, and you plastered and everything, and the plaster would get broken, then it wouldn't even hold the water. So they had exchanged God, who was a fountain of running water, for this cistern, and the cistern was cracked, and so it wouldn't even hold the water. The contrast is huge. God was a bubbling spring of constantly renewing fresh living or running water, what Judah had rejected in favor of digging out and plastering their own cisterns to collect and hold stale rainwater, only then to see the cisterns turn out to be broken, unable even to hold the stale rainwater. Now God takes this illustration one step further and explains what he's talking about in verses 14 to 18. First of all, in rejecting the Lord, Judah had brought a loss of blessing on herself in accordance with the judgments predicted in the Mosaic covenant in Deuteronomy 28. Though Judah had not been a servant or a slave by birth, she had become a plunderer for Gentiles that had roared against her as an attacking lion and destroyed her land, burning her towns and leaving them deserted. The reference to Memphis in the King James, I think it's the word Noph, but it actually should be Memphis, and Tapanes, these are cities in Egypt, refer either to Pharaoh Shishak's invasion of Judah in 925 BC in 1 Kings 14, 25 to 26, or to Pharaoh Necho's killing Josiah in 609 in 2 Kings 23, 29 to 30. There's an interesting story there in 1 Kings 14. It shows you the tragedy of Judah, and I'll just read it here. 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 25. It came to pass in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasure of the king's house. He even took away all, and he took away all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. Solomon had made these shields of solid gold, and he'd hung them up decoratively in the hallway of his palace. All right? Well, King Rehoboam made in their place brass shields. He didn't have any more gold, so he made brass shields. Brass kind of looks like gold, but it's not nearly as expensive. And committed them to the hands of the chief of the guard, which kept the house of the king's door. And it was so that when the king went into the house of the Lord, that the guard bare them and brought them back under the guard chamber. In other words, they would put them under lock and key so no one could see them. But when the king came out, they would hang these shields up. But instead of being gold shields that hung up all the time, they were brass shields that hung up just part of the time. This demonstrates the deterioration that had begun to occur in the land of Judah. And it was all sad because of their apostasy. It's just amazing. But that was what was going on. So in both instances, Egypt triumphed over Judah and shaved the crown of Judah's head by thus defeating and humbling her. In those days, if you were taken into captivity, your head could be shaved, especially if you were a woman. And that was something that was very humiliating because the woman in that era wanted to have long hair. So if they shaved her bald, it was a public humiliation. But that's often what they would do. They would demean people when they took them captive like that. And that's what had happened to a number of the Jewish people at that particular time. Well, God added that Judah brought this calamity on herself by forsaking the Lord when he had led her in the way out of Egypt and into the promised land. Second, after rejecting the Lord, the source of her living, or that is running water, she had dug out her own cisterns to collect water. One of those cisterns being meant to collect the water of Egypt's Shihor, which is an arm extremity of the Nile River, and the other cistern being meant to collect the water of Assyria's Euphrates River. So Judah had turned from trusting the all-sufficient God for blessing to make treaties with frail and eventually futile Egypt in her south, and frail and eventually futile Assyria to her north in vain hope of securing protection and blessing. And both of these were forms of idolatry. It's interesting. They were actually committing a form of idolatry that is very typical of what even a Christian might do today, substituting God for some other source of protection or provision, whether it is the bank account, whether it is a personality, anything that substitutes for the Lord. And that's exactly what they were doing. So God warned Judah that her wickedness would punish her, and her backsliding from him would rebuke her, leading to calamity and bitterness and forsaking the Lord and not revering him. Verse 19, thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backsliding shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that it is an evil thing and bitter that thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that my fear is not in thee, saith the Lord of hosts. So, for rejecting God, her source of true rich blessings, for the stale blessings of Egypt and Assyria, Judah committed a terrible sin, unlike even pagan nations, by exchanging her Lord, the true God, at that, for inferior crutches that would prove to be broken and hence useless anyway. So she left herself open for bitter calamity. So may we hold to God as our sole source of blessing, not replacing him in sad futility with any crutch.